Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. For residents of Philadelphia's Kensington and Fairhill neighborhoods, the cleanup of the infamous drug and trash-ridden gulch along the Conrail tracks can't come soon enough. It's an area haunted by hollow-eyed addicts and filth, the detritus of addiction in large part to heroin. And many, if not most days, the gulch also contains the bodies of those whose love-hate relationship with the drug ultimately killed them. As we've been reporting, it's a scenario being played out in some form, large and small, across the region and indeed across the nation. The Federal Drug Administration says drug overdose deaths rose 37% in Pennsylvania last year, a record slicing across cities, suburbs, and rural areas. So this hour, we'll get the latest on efforts to contain and subdue the opioid epidemic, as we begin by catching up with Mike Newell, who's been reporting extensively on the heroin disaster for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome back to Radio Times, Mike.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
And Councilwoman Maria Quiñones-Sanchez is with us as well. Good to have you back with us, Maria.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you're listening in to this hour of Radio Times, the number is 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times or an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. So, Councilwoman Quiñones-Sanchez, let's begin with you. You represent the district in which the gulch is located. And at last word, I hear the cleanup is set for next Monday?
We're hopeful. I mean, it's a very complicated situation with a lot of moving parts. But definitely by the July 31st, as signed by Conrail and the mayor.
So what does the cleanup entail exactly? Do you know?
It's really the aesthetics, and I think the bigger story is, once you clean up the aesthetics, what do we do with the thousands of people who've been trapped in this neighborhood, who've watched this kind of brew and spill over, and how do we provide support for the folks who need treatment, whether that's in Philadelphia or their home county? It's important that people realize that the majority of the people down there, 70-80%, are not from Philadelphia and not from that community.
So do we know then immediately what happens to these folks?
Well, we are going to be triaging. There's a coordinated effort. I must say this administration, more so than the last administration, has been more willing to put all hands on deck. There will be a coordinated effort with our stakeholders on the ground who've actually been working at this many, many years. Prevention Point, when I first got elected, was operating out of a mobile van. It now has a full-fledged facility with nurses and folks available. We will coordinate a pop-up shelter like we do in the winter to try to triage folks. And the administration is being very flexible about transportation and other requirements. So there will be a full-fledged outreach. My estimation is that in the beginning, people will not accept treatment. And I think the larger narrative is, how do we not make it okay for people to think that they can come buy cheap heroin and shoot up in North Philadelphia?
Mike, let's get you into the conversation here. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be easy to get everybody into treatment. And you actually you've written a number of articles on this for the Philadelphia Inquirer, very effectively. In one, you stood atop the roof of an abandoned carpet factory in Kensington, and you looked down. And from there, you kind of extrapolated, well, you know, here's where some of this is happening. But if people are pushed out, then where do they go? Tell us more about that.
Well, yeah, I think the view from above and the view on the ground and the common thread through the columns has been, one, understanding the gravity and the scope of this crisis. And then two, that though I agree with the council and I applaud the current administration's their momentum on the issue, that we can no longer just push human beings around, push the problem around. I think that the cleanup and the view of the neighborhood from above, it shows that this is a great opportunity to really affect and reach people. But it's also an opportunity to look at the decades of treatment, of practice in the city, and ask ourselves, is it working? How can we reach more people? I think the answer will be, No, there's a lot of gaps and barriers and shortfalls in treatment. And how we have to ask ourselves right now, why are people turning down services to treatment? And how can we make that treatment more effective, get it to people quicker, get people the help they deserve? I think right now there's a heroin crisis in the nation, and there's a heroin catastrophe in Kensington. If you look at the numbers in Philadelphia, I think it's 48 out of 100,000 deaths for overdoses. Other cities like New York and Chicago, that number is like more of 10 and 11. So we can no longer treat this like a behavioral health problem. We have to treat it like the medical emergency that it is right now. And the response right now has to meet that. It can fall nothing short of that right now.
So in looking at recommendations from the Mayor's Opioid Task Force, in dealing with this sort of problem, what are the gaps and the shortfalls?
Well, Savannah and others will talk better about it, but I think and this has been a process for me, but what I'm learning about is the IDs. The need to have IDs is a huge barrier to treatment, especially for the people down in that train gulch. The delays in getting people medically assisted treatment that is proven to be what helps. In Philadelphia, that takes way too long. The lack of housing first options, which meet addicted people where they are, gets them stable and safe, and then wrap services around them. And I think also if you read all the columns, what were they? There were a library lawn that was serving as a sort of sanctuary. It's a train gulch where people are living in squalor and desperation. It's
a
boarded up church where there's one small entrance through a window where people are being re-victimized, where women are being re-victimized, where people are, you know, it's not a safe place. So I think we have to steer the conversation. If we don't have the resources, even if we're trying to meet the resources and better the treatment, if we don't have it, how do we keep human beings alive? How do we keep them better their future, keep them from being re-victimized, catching diseases? And I think that conversation has to move towards safe injection sites in Philadelphia. We have such a tremendous, extraordinary problem here, and it has to be met with an extraordinary response, and we have to think out of the box.
And we'll get to that in just a moment. Mm-hmm. After the break, safe injection sites and more. We will bring at some point Silvana Mazzella of Prevention Point Philadelphia and Carol Rostashore of Angels in Motion after the break into the conversation. They have lots to say. But Councilwoman Quiñones Sanchez, I know you only have a few moments with us. One piece of this story is also tackling the problem of heroin supply in the area. And, you know, I've been reading, you know, for area teens who deal drugs, this is lucrative money. So, you know, there have to be legitimate jobs in the area, too. Am I on point with that?
Yeah, no. Jobs is absolutely essential. I think we have a very coordinated effort now led by our DEA director, Tuggles. We've met with the commissioner. There's a lot of ongoing reviews and investigations. You've seen certain raids recently in the last few months. We expect more. But we are trying to go for the middle person, right? We understand that the neighborhood needs jobs, and we're working along the commercial corridor and bringing supermarkets and doing other things. But this is a generational shift, and it didn't happen overnight. It's going to take us a while to get out of it. We can't arrest our way out of this, but we definitely need to be more strategic about how we police the area, again, and change the narrative. I think this issue of people from outside the city coming there and thinking it's okay to shoot up, as we begin the discussion about should an injection site be in that area or in the counties where the majority of the users are coming from, is one that will be debated. But let's not forget the people who are trapped there, who watch this kind of spiral out of control. And they deserve to live in peace and some quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Maria Quiñones Sanchez, again, you're only with us for a couple minutes here at the top of this show. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us. And I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Talking about quality of life, you know, again, as we're going into the break, Mike, I'd like to just take a few moments to talk about your story about what had been dubbed the Cathedral of Kensington. It was the Ascension of Our Lord Church in that area. Mm-hmm. And you wrote pretty movingly about a story that's breathtaking in the worst sort of way. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that story was kind of a culmination of other stories where over this summer, the media attention has brought a response. the challenge now is for the response to be met with action, real action, helpful action. But we saw the city taking action at Gurney Street. We see after the articles about McPherson Square, we saw an added police presence there. So we're kind of shifting the problem around. And I'm trying to highlight the problem, put it before people. But what happens then is, you know, the people go into the church. And they in the last few months, more people started living there or staying there. A small population of people living there, but coming in and out. It was a place, obviously, boarded up. No heat, no running water, living in squalor. It was dark. The city went, and when I wrote about it, I knew the city would close it down. But I thought it highlighted the just what's happening, the problems being moved, and that can no longer happen. And the city then offered services, and the six or seven kids who were still there, they didn't want those services. And I think that even highlights it more. Why not? And everyone is an individual, but I think it gets to the larger question that needs to be asked now is what do we need to do as a city to help that neighborhood and help that population that are suffering and to get past the stigma that is really hurting this reaction.
One of the things you're going to talk about after the break is who these people are who are using and the humanity of these folks, and you got to know some of them. And as Maria was saying before she while she was still with us here a few moments ago, you know, a lot of them are from out of town. Mm-hmm. But there are people from all walks of life. Could you tell us?
Yeah,
about
I mean
that, Mike?
You walk and you know you meet people in that neighborhood who've been suffering with this problem long before the media attention, long before it became a thing that's affecting white people everywhere else. You meet Elvis Rosado Prevention Point, who's been in that neighborhood forever, and on some days during this crisis he's saving four people at a time through Narcan at one time. I mean, so you meet people like that, but then you also see a population with a lot of kids from Bucks County. They actually call them the county kids, the neighborhood kids on the avenue. You see them with their backpacks and in some cases, you know, rolled luggage. And they come here, they get off the L, and sometimes they don't leave. And then they're in that neighborhood. And again, we need to figure out how to best treat them.
Within the church, though, within the church space, some would not use in the main part of the sanctuary.
Yeah,
it's
I mean,
the moment
well,
of humanity
I think
that you were kind of writing about.
Well, I mean, also kids who are from the county didn't grow up in those neighborhoods. I don't think it's coincidence that they're seeking out familiar places, a library lawn, a church. There is a community. They're seeking out, you know, human connection. And, you know, like Gurney Street and other places, that became a place that to them was a shelter. It was one that was dangerous, one that is not what they deserve. But I think that, you know, it's no coincidence that they kind of seek out places that might be familiar.
Yeah, and perhaps a bit of a comfort, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, you want to have connection.
All right, we're talking about the opioid crisis, not only in Kensington, but we're going to talk about the region, the Philadelphia region as well. Mike Newell of the Philadelphia Inquirer is with us for the full hour. We'll also hear from Carol Rostisher from Angels in Motion and Silvana Mazzella of Prevention Point Philadelphia. And if you'd like to join the conversation, lines are open, 888-477-9499. Radio Times continues in a few moments. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moscawain has the day off. And this hour, we're talking about not only the cleanup of the heroin encampment along the Conrail tracks in Philadelphia, which is supposed to begin next Monday, but we're also taking the story and we're looking at the city and we're looking at the region. And we've got Mike Newell with us. He is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer who's written extensively on this story. And also joining us now, Silvana Mazzella is Associate Executive Director for Prevention Point Philadelphia. Welcome to Radio Time, Silvana.
Hello.
And Carol Rostisher is president and founder of a group called Angels in Motion, a nonprofit which works to change the way those suffering with the disease of addiction are treated. So nice to have you here with us, Carol.
Thanks for inviting me.
And we've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So, Carol, let's begin with a little bit of your story. You were a resident of the Kensington area, and I'm guessing, you know, the narrative we were talking about getting into this probably hits home for you on any number of levels. You've got two in your family who have struggled with heroin addiction. Can you tell us just a little bit?
My son was on the streets of Kensington on and off for 5 years. And that's how I became familiar with what was going on down there. Going down to find him, and I was finding different individuals who were homeless and living on the street. And some of them were from Kensington. And I would sit back and watch, and people would actually drive by like they were invisible. One gentleman still sticks in my head to this day. He would put his head down, hold a cup and a sign, and never look or speak to anyone. And cars would just go by him. And I literally pulled over and thought, that could be my son. That can be my son. He's not there yet, but he can be there. So I started stopping at McDonald's and getting him something to eat. He still wouldn't talk to me. And this went on for a couple months. And then finally we started talking. And we grew a relationship. He actually has spent Christmas at my house and Thanksgiving. Him and my son have become friends through this. And thank God for today, he's in recovery. He did have a slip. He was in recovery before, but he's back in recovery again, and he's trying. And I think a lot of people tend to forget the part that this is a disease that stays with people. It doesn't go away.
You don't like the word junkie?
No, I hate the word junkie. I hate the word addict, too. Words matter.
Well, how do we describe it then? What is
someone suffering with addiction, someone with substance use disorder? Would you describe anyone that you know, a relative that has heart disease, as, hey, this is heart disease, my child? I would never say that about my child. This is my son. His name is Drew. He's a tattoo artist. He's in recovery and he's doing a hell of a job at life.
Yeah.
I don't want my son described as the addict.
Carol, let's get to the cleanup we've been talking about at the Conrail tracks. You were talking to our producer, Debbie Builder, and the sense that she got was that this is not something you're 100% happy with. Was that on point?
Yeah, that's on point. Okay, because, again, these are individuals. They're people. People are saying, oh, we're going to go down there. We're going to offer resources. We're going to have a resource table set up. If they don't know you, you don't know what's going on in their life, the trauma, the devastation. Things have happened to them in their childhood. Things have happened to them on the streets. They just don't trust people very easily. You have to build a relationship with them. You just don't one day pop up with a tent and a table and say, oh, we're here to help you, and think that they're going to believe after they've tried to get in treatment numerous times and been turned away or gotten detox. And sorry, there's no treatment beds. So where are they left to go? Back on the streets.
So I'm going to bring Silvana into the conversation and Mike back into the conversation too. But just one more follow up. What would you like to see happen then to that area? Because the living conditions are terrible for the people who are there.
They are terrible. But like Mike said, what we're doing is we're moving them from place to place to place. That is not helping. If we could build rapport with these people, open up a community center where they could come in and sit and talk to people, have people who are recovery specialists, peer specialists, work with them day in and day out, not for 3 days and disappear, not for one day and disappear. They need consistency.
Silvana, what are your thoughts?
I think that all of the epidemic that's been happening, both the heroin epidemic, the overdose epidemic, and all of the press has brought attention to an issue that really needs to be addressed. And there's a human side that we're talking about. It's most certainly the people living there and facing addiction and struggling. Nobody wants to be living that way. It's also the residents that live there. There are certainly residents that are affected by what's happening and need to see some change in their community. They are impacted as well. But I do think that, you know, at the end of the day, regardless of what happens for a few days, for a few weeks, or in the press, we're planning on doing the work. There are other agencies. Angels in Motion is one of them, Project Home, ODOT, Prevention Point, the city. There are people that are out there talking to people every day. We have a facility that Carol often works out of, like the one that you're talking about, a place where people can come, get a meal, get coffee, talk to someone. You can ask for treatment, you can ask for harm reduction supplies, or you can just sit there and tell people, not today. And what we're going to do is the work. We're going to go out there and assess people and triage people and talk to people and try to build relationships. That's what we do, and that's what the people that have been working out there have been doing.
I think to Savannah's great point there about the neighborhood, there's a corner off Indiana, I think Clearfield in Indiana, where the community has kind of renovated a little park and made it a place where kids can have movie night. And right across from that, you have a little cut in the block that has for a long time been a place where people sit on crates and do drugs. And I think that's a if you look at that one corner, you can say, well, how do we best get these people into a safe, stabilized place that are suffering through a disease that should not be in a cut on a milk crate? And how best do we serve the kids in that neighborhood who has someone just said perfectly to me the other day that should be able to walk down and get a water ice on Indiana Avenue and not see that? And I think that's the challenge here, is looking at has a crisis that if these folks were coming up from a flood or a fire, you would meet them with beds, you would meet them with blankets and say, how best do we meet every one of your individual needs while balancing how best do we serve those kids? And Casey O'Donnell from Impact can talk great about this, who are seeing these traumatic situations and living in that community.
This takes money. Are the resources mm-hmm. there, the funding to make that enormous change?
Well, I don't, and Savannah could talk much better about this, but it also takes prioritizing.
It sounds as if the Kenney administration has
it is, but we're talking about decades of practice that it doesn't take takes more than a minute to turn around. But I think the conversations have to start working, turning toward the barriers to treatment, the delays in treatment, the best practices.
And also, some people do not want treatment. We brought that up in the first segment, mm-hmm. and I'd like to address that. Is that a minority of the people who are who are, say, let's just use the Conrail tracks, who are there, a majority? I have been reading and doing my research for this show that for many addicts, because of their disease, the high is the thing. They don't like their high being disrupted, especially if they're brought back from Narcan. So how do you attack that piece of it, Savannah?
Addiction is complex, and there's not just addiction and craving. There's chemical dependence. And when you're talking about opioids, heroin in particular, but prescription opioids, you are talking about chemical dependence, and you're talking about, we want to believe that people who are getting high are, euphoric all the time and just want to be high. And the reality, especially when someone has lost it all and is living, in an encampment, in an abandoned building, this isn't about getting high anymore. This is about getting well. This is about not vomiting, not having chills and fever, not being able to not move, having diarrhea, being sick, and being in withdrawal all the time. So there are certainly people who are getting high, but there are a lot of people that have a chemical dependence that is very real. And the question is, how do you meet the need for that many people given the system we have? We have a better system than other cities. We have much more methadone than other cities. The city, in response to this crisis in the last year, has added buprenorphine and Vivitrol slots, way more than other cities. But we can't even meet the need in a city like this. So how do we, as Mike said earlier, how do we decrease that time to treatment so you can get medicated quickly enough that you don't need to go out and use so you're not in withdrawal?
We have an email from Teresa. Let me just jump in with this really quickly, Carol, who asks, is there any way that this group of addicts or any group really can be helped that does not involve their consent? So if they're doing something illegal like using these drugs publicly, can they be arrested and instead of being put in prison, be mandated to a long-term treatment facility? So for those who refuse treatment, legally they can't be forced into detox, correct?
Correct. They cannot be forced in, and forcing them in doesn't work. If you force someone into detox and then when they leave, they don't go on to treatment because you can't keep forcing them. They go and use, and that's where a lot of overdoses happen, and that's how we lose a lot of people.
So for the person who feels they can't stop, and this is the last question on this line of questioning, who feels they don't want treatment, what are the answers in your opinion, Carol?
They're the people we meet where they are. We stay with them. We talk to them. Mm-hmm. We encourage them. We let them know that it is possible. You have to understand something. They lose all hope. They've lost hope. My son has said to me, you know what? When I was out there, I had no feelings except for this is it. I'm going to die right here. That was it. That was his feelings. He had no hope of finding help. He had no hope that he could do it. You need to reach that hand out and help them up. You need to stay with them and encourage them.
And I think part of this, though, is the idea that they don't want treatment. That's part of the stigma aspect of this. Mm-hmm. The question has to be, why do they not want treatment? How do we get them into treatment? Because that's the same argument you can say about people who've suffered domestic violence, sexual assault. Well, they didn't want to turn someone, and they didn't want to do it. These are people who are suffering through such catastrophe and addiction, and I think even that phrase we have to be careful with. And again, this has been a process for me. I saw addiction, heroin addiction, very close up front when I was growing up, and a family member lost a family member to it. But the education that I'm getting from the people on the front lines, like Savannah and Carol and other folks down there, and I think a big part of that is, and I do applaud the city's steps that they're taking, but I think it's an opportunity for the entire city to ask themselves, how do we look at addiction? How do we treat it? How do we even talk about it? The word addicts and junkies, and they don't want help.
Yeah.
No, they don't want to be living in a train gulch, you know, but we're not right now. We haven't been able to bring them up successfully.
You had brought up earlier in the show, you brought safe injection sites up. We did a show on this a while back. It's in Vancouver. They have instituted a safe injection site. For a while, it was considered, I think, briefly in Philadelphia, and it did not fly here. Can you bring us up to speed on that, Mike, at least for the moment?
Yeah, I think Savannah and Carol could talk better about this. And like I said, this has been something that I've been coming to in the last few days. My paper has been against safe injection sites. I think that they're wrong in that aspect. I think that it's a conversation that we have to have if we, with the scope of the crisis we have here, if we don't have this, even how good we're trying, if we don't have the resources on the ground right now, if we don't have the best practices in place, even if we are making strides, then how do we just best keep people alive? It's a simple question that has to overrule everything else. Is how do we keep them alive? How do we keep them from being victimized, whether it be in a church or in a train gulch? And how do we keep them from not contracting diseases that, if we can get them out, or if they can get out of addiction, that it's not going to to change their life moving forward in a bad way?
We've got a lot of calls coming in. Let me get to some of them. Jeff in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Okay, thanks. What's your question or comment?
As the mother's comment about the hopelessness and helplessness of her son is significant. And I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I think the issue concerning the supply is a major problem, because the kids on the street that are selling are just as hopeless in their economic outlook as the users. And the money that they make is money that they use to pay phone bills, electric bills, rent, and put food on the table for their family as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's a circular argument, not just to address the addiction issues, which I believe the Vancouver housing issue for safe injection should be paramount for those entrenched users.
Yeah. But Jeff, I'm going to jump in just for a moment because we're up against the clock. You bring up a couple important points, and at the beginning of the show, we were talking with Councilwoman Quiñones Sanchez about that. I'd read that youth make $400 a day if they're doing this, if they're selling, and if there are no jobs, what are the choices that they have?
I think this gets to a pretty important point, too. Yeah,
If
you talk to some of the kids dealing in their corner, some of them might be dealing not only to support themselves, or not only because they live in a block where there's no jobs, but there's $1 million drug operation three steps from the doorway, but also because the epidemic that we didn't didn't attack 10, 20 years ago, when it was their parents who were addicted, they might be selling drugs to support their own parents' addiction. I think that we have to really look at the idea that this is a long-ignored, entrenched problem in that neighborhood that maybe right now we're turning our attention towards, but we have to turn towards in its full complexity.
We have an email from Stu who says, addiction wasn't a crisis as long as it was perceived to be a black problem. Only when it spread to white people was serious attention paid. It has always been so. Carol, you have thoughts on that? You're nodding your head.
You know what? Because I agree with her. Addiction has been going on for years. Okay, Kensington has been this way. I grew up there. I didn't leave until I was 26. There was drugs going on there. And it's the truth. As soon as young white people started becoming addicted, everybody opened up. The press came out. People, this can't be happening. What about the young black people that were addicted on crack in the 80s? I didn't see a big uproar then.
Silvana, let's talk about because we talked about these kids coming in from the suburbs with the backpacks. Quite often it begins, again, with the opioid prescription that is in the parent's cabinet, and or even the child has been, the young person has been prescribed opioids. Talk about that path.
This is an equal opportunity medical condition, right? I personally don't like the term disease, but I just want to say that out of the 900-plus people that died last year, 56% were white, but 32% were African-American. And we see more women dying as well now. This is affecting everyone. We certainly have people from all of the surrounding counties coming. We have people from Puerto Rico coming. We have people from other cities, including New York, Baltimore. We have cheap drugs in the city. They're localized in a few communities, largely Kensington, and that brings people in. But I do want to say that there are people that have lived in Philadelphia all their lives, as was said earlier by Carol and Mike, generations of families. I know people who, unfortunately, were introduced to heroin by their parent, by their older brother or sister, by a grandparent, sometimes as young as 7 or 8, by a boyfriend. And that was in the community. That was in South Philly. That was in Kensington. That was in West Philly.
So it's an entrenched problem. We've got about 15 seconds before the break. Do you think that, as well-meaning as the Kennedy administration is enough being done coming out of the opioid task force?
I think
a
lot
is
being done, but we've got to think out of the box and throw everything against the wall. We can't just do methadone. We have to do buprenorphine. We can't just do behavioral health. We have to do medical providers.
All right. Silvana Mazzella is with Prevention Point at Philadelphia. Carol Rostisher is with Angels in Motion. And Mike Newell, columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We're talking about the opioid / heroin epidemic, not only in Philadelphia, but beyond. And again, 888-477-9499 if you'd like to jump into the conversation. There's more of Radio Time straight ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. 906 people died of drug overdose in Philadelphia last year. This year, officials are saying the number of overdose victims is expected to be even higher. And the cleanup of the heroin encampment along the Conrail tracks in Philadelphia apparently now is supposed to start on Monday. We're talking about a whole number of issues associated with this. In studio with us, Mike Newell, who's columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Carol Rostisher, president and founder of Angels in Motion, and Silvana Mazzella, who is associate executive director of Prevention Point Philadelphia. No surprise, lots of calls and comments coming in, so let's get to some of them. Jabbar in Philadelphia, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. I just wanted to weigh in. This issue is very passionate to me. I work at one of the crisis centers in Philadelphia where if an addict wanted to get help with his addiction, he has to go to one of the crisis centers to be evaluated by a psychiatrist. So that part is not even being talked about. I'm the person that would have to pre-cert if he has insurance. And if he doesn't have insurance, I'm also the person that's trying to get him insurance through the city. But for this, and somebody had mentioned it earlier about the system has been fractured for a long period of time. It's not going to get better until we actually have a show where the Office of Mental Health is actually at the table, where they're actually going to the crisis centers, because we're being overwhelmed at the crisis centers right now with folks with addictions, with opiates. And not even talking about the mental health component, that they're not even doing drugs, but it's just so many people at our crisis centers who have insurance, who have ID. There's not enough beds in the city, so what's happening is, so it's not, I heard somebody mention earlier about if somebody didn't want a treatment, but these folks came in voluntarily for treatment, but there's not enough beds in the city, so they're going home, you know.
Or they're taking a short walk back to the dealers, as I read in an article recently. Jabbar, thank you so much for calling us, calling into Radio Times. Number of important points. I think, Mike, you brought this up earlier. A lot of these folks don't have IDs.
Well, and Silvana will speak to this perfectly about, the barriers, the IDs, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I mean, ID is a huge issue, right? So you
if
have
you don't
to
have an ID, do you get treatment?
So very recently, the Division of Behavioral Health issued a letter letting treatment providers and CRCs, crisis response centers and other assessment centers, know that people can use other forms of ID. You can use a copy of an ID. So we have to verify who you are. But yes, ID has been an issue, and it's been a challenge for people. If you have insurance in another county that hasn't been closed off, that's an issue. Interestingly, if you don't have insurance but have Philly ID, it's actually easier to get treatment. But yes, there's a huge pressure on the beds, as this gentleman was saying. So there are limited beds. There are outpatient slots for methadone and buprenorphine. The problem is, if you get into a bed, you will be medicated in a reasonable period of time. If you go the outpatient route, there's no way to say when you will get medicated. There are a few providers that do a fabulous job of easy access, do the right lab work right away, drug screen, and get you medicated. But if you're going to wait 3, 4, 5, 6 days to get medication, you create this situation where there's a huge pressure on the beds, because people need to be medicated. If not, they're going out into the street to medicate themselves, yeah, or they die in that time that they go into withdrawal and then hit the street, or they get turned down. The other thing is, turn people down quickly and gently. You know, one of the things that I applaud the city for doing in our shop, they come in and assess 3 times a week, and we move to a model. You're not going to get placed. We're going to tell you right away. This is what you have to do. We're going to help you get that ID. It is a very sad thing to tell someone, but let's tell people early in the process, it's not happening. Let us help you make it happen someday. Let's get you ID. Let's get you insurance. Let's switch your insurance. But if you have people waiting for hours, that's not going to happen.
But that also sounds right there like a crisis point, because if somebody's seeking treatment and they are in the throes of an illness that's going to, you know, they're walking right back to their street, you're setting them up for failure.
Especially when there's such, I mean, when it's not just heroin anymore, it's fentanyl and carfentanil, which is so deadly.
It's the disease of addiction, okay? If you go to the hospital and you have a heart attack, they don't tell you there's no beds. They don't tell you we can't help you. They don't tell you you don't have ID, you're not getting in. You're having a heart attack. They help you. If somebody wants help and they have the disease of addiction, they don't always get help. It's not that easy. It's very hard, actually. There really are not enough beds in the city, whether detox or treatment.
Where would these beds, if we were to build more treatment centers, where would they be located and are communities welcoming?
They can be anywhere. They could be anywhere and everywhere.
I mean, are communities welcoming towards the
people? Hospitals.
Yeah, and also, I mean, right now people are living on the streets.
Right,
I mean,
and you have to realize this is everywhere across the city. So, say Northeast. Well, I tell you, my son was from the Northeast. A lot of his friends who unfortunately have passed and did not make it were from the Northeast. What, they wouldn't want a treatment center there to help their children?
Yeah.
Why not?
NIMBY is an interesting, that's a whole other show. Not my backyard.
It's also, you know, we keep talking about this being a crisis or epidemic. It's time to throw everything against the wall. You know, one of the things that we know is that physicians, primary care, infectious disease, hepatologists, physicians, psychiatrists can get waivered to provide buprenorphine in the context of medical care. And as Carol just said, you know, you wouldn't go somewhere for a medical issue and get told, well, no, you have to go somewhere else. Well, no, you have to go somewhere else. Part of the problem is the stigma of addiction and dependence, right? You're going to a behavioral health facility. You're going to a detox. You're going to this. We have the opportunity to normalize and accept people and destigmatize this medical condition by having every physician at every medical visit screen people for overdose. We now have physicians screening for domestic violence. Why not screen for chemical dependence, for addiction, and offer treatment in the context of care? We have some great doctors doing that.
Is part of the problem that there is this perception that, well, you got yourself into this and you can get yourself out of it?
I think that's right at the heart of that. They don't want treatment. And that going forward on Monday or whenever it is that the city arrives at that train gulch, that has to, the opposite of that has to guide everything. Not that, well, they don't want treatment. Why do they not want treatment? How do we get them into treatment? The crisis here is at the level where if someone comes to Prevention Point and says, I want treatment, then it's a sin if they can say, have to say, well, no, we can't get you because you don't have an ID. Come back in 30 days or 3 weeks. okay, well, that person has to self-medicate now, and they're doing it with, you know, elephant tranquilizers that are on the street. I mean, there isn't time. You know, we can't, if we've got 900 deaths this year and it's at 1,200 deaths next year, and the year after that is 2,000 deaths, I mean, how many people are we going to let die?
Well, again, what I'm hearing in this show is that we need more resources. And again, the Kenney administration is trying to tackle this bit more than what is happening now. Mike, do you know offhand how much money it has been set aside by the opioid or for the opioid task force to do its work? I know I'm catching you off guard.
You're not. I think, and they can back me up, I think of the millions and millions of dollars that they're putting towards the cleanup, it's $250,000 for actually treatment and resources, which is a very small fraction of it. And
well, so how much is necessary?
I don't know. Some of these might not be. I mean, some of these are. If you look at what could be, again, getting back to the safe injection site, but you know that could be a lot. I think more economically viable for our city than some other things. But if you look, is it a huge costly fix to maybe for the city or the state to say, hey, for the next month or two, we're going to give you an ID waiver. I don't know if that costs a lot of money. If doing some type of outreach or program to doctors to open up some of these medically assisted treatment slots, which Savannah told me the other day would cause it from to go to 600 to the thousands. So I think some of this is not only financial. Yes, it's prioritizing the finances, but also changing the conversation.
Yeah. All right, back to the phones. Frank in Philadelphia, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. You know, this may have been brought up before, but I think until you change the incentive for the pharmaceutical industry, which is profit, and for the doctors to not feel that they're not taking care of their patients, which are both not the right, try to do the right thing but for the wrong reason, or the doing the wrong thing for the right reason, we're not going to get anywhere. And actually, the whole opioid thing is really just part of the larger problem. When you have an industry called the insurance industry delivering health care, it is like the fox watching the chicken coop.
All right, Frank, thank you for calling to Radio Times. Again, a number of points there. Very quickly, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has found that the number of patients receiving opioids, doctors are prescribing opioids less often, which is a positive, but still the number of patients receiving opioids is too high, at least according to the CDC, and doctors are giving patients prescriptions that last longer, so there's more opportunity than to become hooked on these prescriptions. Carol, how did he walk that walk?
My son started with partying.
Okay.
Okay, he had learning differences growing up, and in order to fit in, he started partying, and he had fun. And I partied a lot when I was growing up. I did crazy that's why I relate to them so well on the streets, because I know what they're going through. And not everybody can party and stop. Some people can't say no because they have it changes their brain chemistry, and they just keep going and keep going. And then when they want to stop, my youngest had said to me, he still doesn't drink, my youngest, he's 18 years old, never had a drink. He says to me, I never want to wind up like my brother. I'll never forget him sitting there and looking me in the eyes and saying, I want to stop, Dale, I really do, but I can't. I don't know what's wrong with me.
So let's, again, I just like to get to the meat of the matter. Sylvain, what do you think needs to happen going forward, over and above what is happening in the city now, to tackle this problem?
We need to think about this differently. We need to think outside the box. We need to include non-traditional partners. You know, we've looked at addiction and dependence as a behavioral health problem. It's in the rubric of mental health and substance use. If we look at it as a medical condition and include treatment and screening in the context of other care, we can drastically reach more people. And in terms of a resource issue, it's not that much of a resource issue for a doctor who's already seeing someone to do an additional screening. It is difficult to do. There's insurance authorizations, all of that, but we can do that. We can also change how we look at people. You know, right now we look at super users, people with long-standing histories of dependence and opioid dependence as frequent flyers. We need to look at them as our most high-risk individuals, the people who may die tomorrow, and treat them differently. So it requires a change in thought. It requires destigmatizing this problem and making it a chemical problem.
Yeah. We really need to change the judgment. Everybody's so judgmental. It has to stop. These are individuals. They need to be treated like individuals. Their treatment plan needs to be individualized. They need to be cared for.
So I was reading, Carol, that you will get out of your car and hug people who are on the street in the throes of addiction. There's no fear. There's no, this person hasn't, been washed in 2 weeks, or it looks as if they're, many people wouldn't do that. So how do you get beyond that visual image?
They're human beings. That human touch means so much. Isolation feeds the disease of addiction. The more we push these people away, the more we judge them, the more we ridicule them, the more they go lower and lower and deeper into their addiction. The more you reach out to them and hug them and show them you care and show them they're a human being. They have a problem, yes, but they're a human being. We all have problems. We've all made mistakes.
Yeah. Mike, again, the question that I asked a little bit ago, if you could just give us some bullet points in terms of what you think needs to happen from your vantage point as a reporter, as an observer, that goes perhaps beyond what is happening now on the city level to really harness this problem.
Well, I think going forward, again, it has to be, accepting the fact that this isn't a problem that we can, that the decades past efforts haven't worked, that we can't just be about pushing the problem one block further and seeding the previous block. It has to be about destigmatizing. It has to be about looking at things. As Savannah said, we have such an overwhelming crisis here that we have to have an overwhelming response, and I don't think the city has that yet. I think that this is a learning process for all of us together. I mean, I lost a brother to addiction. That doesn't make me any more equipped to write about it, but it makes me much more sympathetic to the people who are suffering from it and to the people who are on the front lines battling it every day and trying to help those folks. So I think it's going to take a change of a mindset, a change of reprioritizing some of our response, but also looking and talking about this in much different ways than we have.
Are you hopeful?
I am. I mean, I think I'm hopeful in the sense that that the attention, for whatever reason, is trying to bring a response. I think that the city and so many other people that I'm meeting out there, I think it's coming from the right place. But I do think that Philadelphia specifically is in such a crisis mode right now that if this was a homicide rate, if we had 1,200 homicides this year, I mean, what would we be doing? So I think it has to be at that level. And we just basically, as individuals and not even as a city in whole, just ask ourselves, how do we keep people alive? And how do we try to help them? And I think that should guide everything going forward.
Good. 10 seconds. Silvana, are you hopeful?
I'm hopeful. I'm always hopeful. We just have to do the work, do the right thing, and try to help as many people as possible.
And Carol.
There's hope. There's people out there in recovery. Share your story. Let others see that it's possible, because it is.
Carol Rostashore of Angels in Motion, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
Silvana Mazzella of Prevention Point Philadelphia, good to have you here as well.
Thank you.
And Mike Newell, thanks so much for joining us. Mike's been covering this story for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Thank you.
Don't forget, check out our Facebook page and podcasts. You'll find them at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nouri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and as always, thanks for joining us for Radio Times.